He's 5'2" and he's 6'4". He fights with missiles and with spears. He's all of 31 and he's only 17. He's been a soldier for 1,000 years. He's a Catholic, a Hindu, an atheist, a Jain, a Buddhist and a Baptist and a Jew. And he knows he shouldn't kill, and he knows he always will. Kill you for me, my friend, and me for you.
Did you, when you were there, and did you served how many, just one tour, or how many tours of duty did you serve in Vietnam?
Just one.
Just one. So you, and at the time you were there, you were, 35 or kind of in that age range?
Yeah.
Okay. So really at 35, if you think about, Vietnam, the average age of the person in Vietnam, the average age of infantry and troops was just a little over 21.
Oh, yeah. There's a lot of infantry there that were just drafted.
In 18 to 21.
Yeah.
What were the, you mentioned about the, sending, people in who didn't have the training that they needed to have to fly, those kinds of things. What to you were some of the hardest parts of being there, to being in Vietnam?
Ooh.
I mean, everyone says it's, it was an honor to serve. I've talked to, I told you Brigadier General Joe Ulatowski, and he said it was an honor for him to serve and to be able to command those men. But it was also very hard because you did see people that you knew that were injured and were killed in battle.
Yeah, it was after an assault. You, if you ran in, if the enemy was waiting for you, you had a lot of wounded. And they would do a triage. These guys can still fight.
Right.
These guys need.
Are not going to make it.
Aren't going to make it. You do a triage, and these guys here need to get to the hospital. So what we would end up doing is we'd underloaded our infantry. If the helicopters were still around, we'd fill them full of wounded and take them to the hospital.
Yeah. How far was the hospital away? Was it within a half an hour, within 20 minutes, or pretty
20
close?
20 minutes, 20, 30 minutes to Saigon.
Uh-huh.
We were defending north of Saigon, so that's where they went.
And how did you keep in contact with your family when you were there? Steve said you wrote to your wife every day.
Just by letters. And this one incident where we didn't get letters for about a month. I tried to figure out what was going on, and turned out that back in Virginia, where my wife was, they had one of these steel mailboxes on the street that the post office wasn't emptying it.
Wondered what was going on all the mail was just piling up in the mailbox.
Clear full, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And I imagine mail day was quite a good day for.
Oh yeah, I like to get a letter every day. I know how things are going.
You got care packages, or
she was taking care of 4 kids back in Virginia. So
wow, so she had plenty to do too.
Well, I only had 2, but my brother, he was taking care of 2 of my brother's kids too. Uh-huh. So there's 4 of them.
Uh huh.
And the only car she had was my old Volkswagen.
Yeah. A small little bug Volkswagen,
yeah,
or
a bug, yeah.
Oh wow, wow, yeah. I drove one of those around in 1966 too, and it had an automatic on the floor. But that was interesting. Do you still keep in contact with some of the people that you serve with?
I hear from people at Christmas time is about all. And I talked to one of my friends down in, he's down in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. And he's, I still keep in touch with him. I've kept it.
And you're 93, correct?
I got one of the guys was a West Pointer who worked for me, and he was and his buddy in Washington D.C. They still keep in touch with me. I get a letter, you know, at Christmas time.
yeah, that's that. You know, did you ever hear of a group of women from the Red Cross called the Donut Dollies?
Oh yeah.
Tell me about the Donut Dollies.
Well, when we were getting ready to go on an air assault, and we're loading up with infantry and everything, they would show up, and they'd be selling coffee and donuts to the troops, which felt kind of strange to me, but it, especially if you were loading up around Saigon, they would be right there.
Were they kind of for morale, I suppose, to kind of cheer everybody up a little bit?
I'll tell you what was worse than that. It was the Christmas of 65. Was that sound about right?
Well, you said you were there about 66 to
Christmas 68, 66.
So right around there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the Bob Hope show showed up. And a place called Zeon, he had two divisions, the 25th Infantry and the 1st Infantry was all there. And, of course, our division commander was nervous about having so many people grouped up in one place.
Because somebody could come in with a sapper or somebody
yeah,
to
yeah,
come in.
Yeah, they thought somebody would come in and try to throw some mortar rounds into that bunch of people. And so I was thinking, well, this isn't so bad. I'll have the day off.
Yeah.
I've been busy.
Yeah.
But that wasn't to be. It said, you are going to be on alert in case there's trouble. So they had a whole rifle company ready to load into my helicopters. And we were parked out on the runway, ready to go, full of fuel and everything. And my gunships, I had 8 gunships, and George Fish was my platoon leader for the gun platoon, and he was ready to go. And but I thought, well, nothing's going to happen, you know, so we were kind of sitting back and relaxing for the day. But at noon, the damn siren went off. And everybody's running to their helicopters. And George got off with his 8 gunships, and I was right behind him with the troops. And what had happened was what they were worried about might happen. They had some infiltrators got in close to Zeon where they could throw some mortar rounds into that packed group of two divisions worth of personnel. And so George got there first, and he laid out a lot of machine gun fire and suppressed the whole situation. And I came along with my troops and made sure it was over. It was a little bit of excitement on the day of the Bob
Hope
show.
Was Bob excited too?
I wasn't allowed to go see the show.
Did you get to see the show?
Huh?
Did you get to see the show?
No.
So you thought it was going to be a day off, and you wound up working.
I wound up, yeah, defending Bob Hope.
Yeah. So there were a lot of people there, it sounds like, at that gathering.
Yeah, it was like, I'm sure a lot of them come out of Saigon, too, but there were thousands of people.
A lot of people came out there to see Bob Hope, Well, when you were you mostly flying into hot zones when you were there, or was a lot of it just kind of back and forth and delivering supplies?
No, it's when I first got there, they put me in B Company, and that was just, they give you a mission and individual, maybe two helicopters. And A Company, the one that I ended up commanding, was the assault company. It did the fighting. B Company had a lot of helicopters too, but it was mainly a support or operation. And I got into a bad situation there where he pulled in. I was only in country about a month, and I had a good friend, from the Philippines that slept in my tent, and I knew him pretty well. His name was Caliboso, Robert Caliboso. And he was from Hawaii, but I think he was a Filipino. But he was a captain. And we got the mission, and one day it says report to and support the 3rd Brigade. They were the Michelin Rubber Plantation.
Report to the brigade?
Report to the 3rd Brigade, yeah.
3rd Brigade.
That's the only thing. And it's, we took off just before sunup to go up there. And I was leading the way. Robert was following me in another helicopter. We didn't know what was going on. They never told us. The only thing you get to is report to and support the 3rd Brigade. You have no idea what's going on when you go there. It could be a beer vendor or whatever. But
could be nothing, or it could be a lot of people.
But when we got there, I was leading the way, and it was pitch black out, of course. Too early in the morning, the sun hadn't come up yet. And when we got there, I started looking down, and I seen these flashes going off all over the place. And what the hell is that? I started maneuvering around a bit, trying to see what the heck was going on. And what I was looking at was a full-scale battle. The brigade is surrounded, and the Vietnamese are trying to overrun. I think that was in March of 66. I had only been in country about a month. And so went on in the land, but Calabosa pulled in front of me while I was doing trying to figure out what was going on down there, and I realized I was looking at a full-scale battle. And he landed first, and I landed second. Well, depending on where you landed was whether you're going to live or die, because the first guy to land was going to get a resupply mission, and they're going to fill his helicopter full of ammunition. mm-hmm. And the second one to land was going to get the brigade commander and his air controller and all that. We're going to fight the battle out of it. Well, that was my helicopter. And he got the ammo, and he got the brigade supply officer. And they took off first. And by the time I took off, he was already dead. Because they asked him to come steer him in over what should have been on friendly territory where they had control of the ground. But they didn't own the ground that they brought him in. They marked it with smoke, you know, saying land here. But I think they landed him right in between the enemy and the friendlies. And so he was dead like that. He unloaded the helicopter, and he turned upside down. When he tried to take off, he turned upside down. But anyhow, that led to a six-hour battle.
That's a pretty long battle, isn't it?
The brigade commander was in my ship, and he had his four air controller and his artillery coordinator. All that was in the back of my ship. So it took six. We flew it 6 hours. And
so they must have had a resupply a number of times in the 6 hours. Or
I had to gas up once.
Right.
But so the Air Force was hitting it with their jets, and they weren't doing much damage to the enemy, to tell you the truth. The low layer of clouds, they had to go fly, dive through a layer of clouds, fire their machine guns, and then pull back up through it. And it was interesting that about the middle of the morning, one of them got shot down. The jet came back out of the sky, down through the clouds, tail first. And
tail first.
I said, "Oh God, he's had it!" And it blew up when it hit. And then all of a sudden, and through the clouds, he comes down in his parachute. He's ejected, but he was going down right in the middle of a battle.
He ejected in the wrong place.
One of the brigade helicopter pilots, armed with just a pistol, went and picked him up in a little helicopter and got him out of there.
So he was saved.
He was a survivor, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah. About noon, the Navy showed up with their dive bombers. And the forward air control was talking to him, and the brigade commander asked him, "What do you got?" And he said, "Well, I got a squadron of Navy dive bombers loitering 10,000 feet waiting for a target." And
you found a target for him.
I could see the enemy trying to pull out. I told the brigade commander that they're breaking contact. He says, "Can you see them?" I says, "I can see them." He says, "Can you mark them?" I said, "Yeah, I can mark them." And I told my door gunners to stow your guns, get out your smoke. We're going to go down and mark the targets. So that's what we did about noon. Went down there. Went down to treetop level, throwing smoke all over the enemy.
So you could see these guys moving around on the ground.
Yeah.
And you dropped the smoke canisters.
Oh, I could see them. They were. The battle was starting to slow down, but they were trying to get away. And so we threw smoke all over them. We pulled up in the Navy. The Navy was flying with 500-pound bombs.
Were they napalm, or were the bombs napalm, or were they
No, high explosive.
Oh, high explosive.
And they do a descending dive. They don't go straight down like this. They're playing the altitude, you know, with that dive, and they hit them really hard. So. That was a victory for the 3rd Brigade. It was on the Michelin rubber plantation, if you've ever heard of the Michelin.
Oh, yeah. Yep.
Yeah. And funny thing about it, later on, I met a guy up here at the Veterans Hospital, and he was carrying a Silver Star from a battle over there, and I asked him where he was at. It was the same damn place a year later.
Wow.
And
the same place a year later.
Same place a year later, and he got the Silver Star, but he told me what I found out is the new division commander had been relieved of command because he lost too many troops. Same place.
Wow. Any instances that you know, you've told me several different things that, you know, that were really important to you, or things that you remember. Are there times when you can literally close your eyes and almost feel like you were back there?
Oh, yeah, I guess so.
Yeah.
One of the big changes was, I can tell you about, is that there's a big change over there between winter and summer.
Between winter and summer?
Yeah. When the monsoons come in, it's a whole different ball game. Heavy, heavy rain every day. And you stay wet.
And what times were the helicopters couldn't fly? When it was it foggy there too?
Well, yeah. After a rainstorm had come through, there were times when it was dangerous to fly. You're flying a formation of. And everybody's on instruments, you know. You hope they can see one another as you go pass through some places. But with the monsoon, everything is totally wet. Your clothes stay wet.
Yeah, I know. I've been in Costa Rica when it's a similar climate. When you know you can't even a piece of paper. You try and pick a piece of paper up, and it's just. It just folds over because it's so moist. That must have, yeah. So it was during the real heavy rains that the helicopters, could they still fly or they couldn't fly or they had to stay on the ground? What?
It could get bad enough they'd ground everything, but you didn't dare take off. But I can remember fighting my way back through the as a single helicopter, not in formation, but fighting my way back underneath clouds, trying to get back to my base or trying to get to where I was supposed to be. You're flying right down at that. Well, this one day I was flying right down to treetop level, and I'm counting enemy troops as I went by them.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Wow. You were that close. You were counting enemy troops.
Yeah, and I don't know why they didn't shoot me down. I still don't know to this day why they got all their guns underneath their ponchos, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Maybe they didn't want me to find them either, but I had
stumbled. Maybe they wanted to stay dry, too, I guess. Maybe they wanted to stay dry, too.
Yeah. Maybe they didn't want to be found. That's probably more like it. They were probably moving.
Mm-hmm. What? Any regrets?
What?
Any regrets from serving there? I mean, just you probably made friends. You bonded with people.
I think the biggest regret is that we couldn't handle it. We should have been able to handle that war. I didn't like it after I got out. Watched the evacuation where everybody's, you know, trying to get into the helicopter on top of the U.S. Embassy and
right
and cut and run and
yeah, that was. I'm sure that was very tough for
one of the things. One of the things you got to realize is that. When I went in, Diem was still the leader of the South Vietnamese government. And in this war, it seemed like the State Department and the CIA were all involved in this thing. And they decided to assassinate President Diem. They killed him in a troop carrying tank, you know. They were trying to move him across town, and somebody decided to assassinate him. And I don't know who that was or why they did it, but after he was dead, the generals started taking over. Diem and some of the other generals, they tried to set them up as the top of the government.
Mm-hmm.
And some of them weren't very popular leaders, and the people weren't going to. The South Vietnamese decided they weren't going to do a lot of fighting.
Yeah, you know that that famous picture of the people leaving on the top of the building and all that. I have a friend that was in the military and now lives in Ho Chi Minh City there, and he said that he had tea with a friend in the bottom floor of that building. that it's now restaurants and, you know, like a little mini mall. So it's interesting how things change.
They tried different generals running the South Vietnamese government. And, of course, there's...
They weren't very successful.
They weren't. And you have to realize, if you go way back to when the French were there at Dien Bình Phu, they lost their battle up there, too.
Right.
When they were surrounded. But the people in the north were... people in the south were Catholic. And the people in the north... I don't know whether they were Protestants or they was something else, but the people, Diem and his people were all Catholic.
Yeah, all Catholics. Well, I think that's... any final thoughts you want to make?
No, I think that's it.
Well, thank you. Thank you. Again, Don Ice, Lieutenant Colonel, 93 now, we're in Olympia with his... with Rick Ames, my engineer, and Steve Ice, his son. And Don, really appreciate you sitting down with us and giving us your thoughts. And now you can have a muffin, as you're having right now. So thank you very much, and thank you, Vaishan, and we will talk to you all soon.
All right.
Again, this is Dr. Steve Nurse. And this has been our pleasure to interview Lieutenant Colonel Don Ice. One of the things that was so poignant when I talked to Don in our closing here was a poem by Robert Frost titled Out, Out. And he specifically remembered the line, "And they, since they were not the one dead, turned to their affairs." Thank you very much for listening.
He's 5'2" and he's 6'4". He fights with missiles and with spears. He's all of 31 and he's only 17. He's been a soldier for 1,000 years.